So I'm very excited and full of joy that I can today welcome Daniel Greenberg to the Conscious Evolution Summit. A very warm welcome to you, Daniel.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah. And I also want to welcome everyone watching the video, listening to the audio. And really, I mean, I want to invite you to take a moment that even though you might sit on your own in your living room or in your car or wherever you are, but really also kind of, I want to invite you to open yourself and to take a moment to feel into the field of consciousness where so many people are meeting, not only in this summit, but also with this common interest to research and dive deeper into what it means to be alive as a human being, as a spiritual being, especially in this time of change where we are in right now. And I just want to bring that to your awareness that we are many, 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 many of us interested in this topic, and I want to bring everyone into this field. And Daniel, maybe we start a bit with you sharing a bit your journey in what brought you that you are interested in consciousness work, in maybe just starting with really you individually as a person and then kind of connected to this larger field where you engage with groups and eco-villages. And
sure. Where to begin? I guess it brings me back to college. I remember I started my undergraduate degree in electrical engineering. And my dream at that time was to really be involved with artificial intelligence. This was back in the early 80s when computers were just sort of coming out. And I thought artificial intelligence was really sort of the cutting edge of society. And soon I started teaching computers to kids in an after-school program and quickly realized I liked kids more than computers. And so I switched my degree to psychology. And then I started dreaming of someday creating a school in a community. A community-based school. And I don't actually know where the idea of community came from. I grew up in the suburbs of Delaware. I recognized there was something I was lacking. And that brought me to a graduate program. I did a PhD in child development and school psychology, naively thinking that would give me the background to start a school, which it didn't. Help me learn how to test kids, put them into boxes, which isn't what I wanted to do. But it did allow me to do a really interesting PhD thesis, which was on children and growing up in communes, essentially. And so I studied the topic probably about 2 years and then hopped into a Westphalia camper van with my then partner, now wife, Monique. And we traveled to about 30 or 40 communes across North America. And I swear, I learned more the first day I stepped foot in a commune, in a community, than probably those 2 years I had spent studying them. And it's hard to describe. It's sort of like, it was like a light switch went on, or it was like I was recognizing that there was a need in me that I didn't even know I had, this need to belong, this need to be in community. And I kind of woke up. It was like these communities were telling stories that I wasn't really hearing, reading about them, but I could really hear being there. And so that was an amazing experience. And then after that, I had to do a school psychology internship. And I wrote to communities all over the world, and Findhorn in Scotland wrote back saying, yeah, we could use some help with our kids. So we ended up going there for a year. And about the middle of that year, a friend brought over some college students. It was one of the first times the college students went as a group to Findhorn. And I saw the same thing happen to those students that happened to me. They like woke up within the space of a week. They were saying things like, I'm not the same person I was before I came here. I'm seeing myself in relationship to this community and the world in a different way. And I remember one night waking up with goosebumps thinking, this is what I got to do. How do I help build this bridge so that more emerging adults, more future leaders can have this experience of being in community? I wasn't thinking so much ecological back then. I was thinking more about community. But then that evolved into an interest in eco-villages And then I started a nonprofit called Living Roots, which partnered with the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. I did that in 98. And we brought students to eco-villages around the world, Findhorn, but also an amazing place in South India called Oroville, Mexico, Peru, Brazil, Australia, Senegal, all over the world. And it was an amazing opportunity. And we brought about 1,500 students to communities around the world, and I think transformed many of their lives. Mm-hmm. I left in 2012 feeling a deeper urgency around climate change, and I started another social venture, which is a personalized carbon pricing mechanism. I could talk more about that. It's a little wonky. And then sadly, Living Roots folded in 2014. And so all the materials came back to me. And then more recently, I've sort of reinvented those programs through a consultancy. It's called CAPE Consultancy, CAPE standing for Custom Academic Programs in Ecovillages. And we're excited to be offering a gap year program in Oroville in the spring. And we're hoping to do more of that. And somewhere along the line, I got really involved in eco-villages, and about 3 years ago, I started serving as president of the Global Eco-Village Network, and so that's been my life. I mean, there's more, but...
Of course, and what kind of, when I listened to you, what made me curious, because you said there happened a kind of an awakening, stepping community and feeling this field, which you recognized on your own and also with students. And I mean, there are very different ways or contexts of where we feel we awaken to something more. And I'm curious, how would you describe, if it's possible to put it in words, to what did you awaken to?
Well, yeah, actually, well, there's another story I remember from college. I can never remember his name, if it's Lewis Thomas or Thomas Lewis. That's what happens when you have first and last names that are both names. I think it was Lewis Thomas. And he wrote a book called Lives of a Cell. And he was a biologist, and he would write essays for the New Yorker or New York Times. And this book, there was one chapter in it about ants and bees. And he was talking about how if you see a single ant, you can't imagine it having much on its mind. I'm trying to change it so that the sun isn't so bright here. Maybe that's a little better. You know, you look at a single ant and you can't imagine it having much on its mind. I mean, it has basically a couple ganglion nerves strung together for a brain. It says if you look at a couple ants, it's almost like they have an idea. You know, they'll start rolling a piece of dirt over and over. But of course, it's only at the level of the anthill where you can start seeing this consciousness emerge, this intelligence emerge. And I don't think he even asked in the chapter, but it's a question that begs asking is, can a single ant have any awareness of that consciousness that exists at the level of the whole anthill? And when I asked myself that, oddly, there was this sense of relief, because up until that point, when I got into college, my story was the world's going to hell, and I've got to fix it, right? And it was incredible. It felt like an incredible burden. And when I read that chapter, I realized, oh, I don't need to fix the world. All I need to do is be the best ant I can be. You know, how can I follow the pheromones, follow my bliss, as it were? And if I do that, then I feel like I'm doing that work of the anthill. And I think we all have that sense. We all have a sense of, am I on path or am I off path? I think that was a question that Carlos Castaneda or Don Juan asked in those books. It's like the only question is, am I following a path of heart? And so that's been a question I've carried with me my whole life. And so I think that was the awakening of being part of something larger. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the sun is coming in here, but I think it's okay.
So for me, on my side, it's okay, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So it's basically this awakening to that you are part of something bigger, what kind of broader relief, so it's not just your work. And also, I mean, it made you curious enough and also engaging you enough to kind of really spend your life again and again putting yourself in this field of some kind of community.
Yes.
And And you also mentioned, maybe to bring some different aspects, this question. So how was it? How did you say the question from Carlos Castaneda?
Oh, that question is, I don't know it exactly, but it's, are we following a path of heart?
Yeah.
Are we on path, essentially? Yeah. Do we feel like we're doing that which we're here to do?
So how does it register in you when you have the feeling you follow it or when you leave it?
That's a good question. Well, for me, I feel happy. I feel relaxed. I feel like there's this sense of there's a big thing to do, perhaps bigger than I could do in a lifetime, but I'm excited to do it. And I feel like I know I can contribute to it. Like I know that this is something that I can help make happen, even if I can't fulfill it completely.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, so I also have the feeling when I tune in to that, I have the same, as you mentioned, this can feel really big and bigger than my lifetime. So it's not just about that I feel good and that it's nice for me. It's even though when we sense that we are kind of tuned into that, there is in general a feeling I'm right, I'm on the right path. But on a personal level, it can also mean that I need to leave my comfort zone, that I need to be challenged, that I need to face something which I don't know. Maybe share a bit about that, because sometimes there is a bit of romantic idea around when we live our path that it's all easy and just fun. And
that's a really difficult question, especially for some serial entrepreneurs, which I guess I could call myself, because there's definitely nights that you're up, you know, all night worried, like, is it going to work? Are the finances are going to happen? Or there's stress and this or that? And the question always is, should I continue? And many people in the entrepreneurial world say, well, yeah, if you stop, you'll never know. And it may be just at that point where something really took off. But for me, it's really kind of just tuning into that inner voice. Like, is this still what I need to do? And just asking that question and listening. Maybe I was just kind of going along and just in a rut and not really asking, you know, but I continually feel that what I've been doing is what needs to be done. And it's also helpful to remember that we don't actually know all of the impacts of our actions. And so we may think we know what success means in the work that we do, but it ripples out. I mean, I meet Living Roots students all over the place. It's really satisfying when they don't even know who I am or that I started it. And they'll start talking about this amazing program that they did. And I'm like, oh, yay. You know, and I hear what they've done in their life. And I'm just like, to me, that is so much more impactful than whether Living Roots continued or how many students or what. You know, I just feel like there's that mystery. And I think also to relax into that mystery and know that there's no way we can know what is the result of all our actions. And then it just comes back to, are we doing what we feel like we should be doing?
And when you kind of remember back, have you always had this connection to this inner voice, which you described?
No, I'd say that also changed a lot in college, probably my sophomore year. I'd say in one semester, I think I learned to meditate. I fell in love. I discovered drugs. You know, I remember going home that break and my parents were like, who are you? So I think there was sort of an awakening. I was doing Tai Chi. So I maybe it was always there on some level, but I do feel like it kind of like grounded probably when I was around 18 or 19. And I started asking the big questions. And to me, that's what Living Roots was all about. You know, taking students to these eco-villages. The eco-villages, they're far from utopias. You know, these are just people like you and me. They're trying to manifest this new way of being. But it forces us to ask ourselves some deep questions. And really all we did was just try to frame that experience for them, mm-hmm. help them ask those questions.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I haven't spent a lot of time visiting different eco-villages. I lived for 6 years in a little community, which I founded with other people together. We were running a seminar center there and a non-profit foundation for cultural change, consciousness and healing work. But I haven't had the chance to visit others. But in a way, I guess they can be very similar also in what they kind of where what is their topic in doing deeper research and what are they engaged in, and it's also maybe different in different countries. And maybe you can share a bit more what do they in a way have in common, what mm-hmm. attracts you, and right. where is the variety or the unique expression, where has this its place?
Right. Yeah, actually, I think it would be helpful to share a little bit about what ecovillages are. I imagine many of the listeners, yeah. it's a concept to them. The way I think about ecovillages are that they are simply groups of people that are both trying to live high quality lifestyles, but at the same time, low ecological impacts. So the question is, how do we live well and lightly at the same time? And because we need to get into this sort of livable zone where everyone on the planet has access to clean water, shelter, education, medicine, right? I mean, there are billions of people on the planet living below what I would call an equity baseline, right? And at the same time, we all need to get below the carrying capacity of the planet and our local ecosystems as well. Unfortunately, very few of us are in that livable zone. And so ecovillages have essentially just staked out that middle ground and saying, these are our laboratories. These are our experiments, our regenerative hubs. You know, how do we strive to create lifestyles, cultures, stories around who we are in relationship to each other and the planet that are both high quality and low impact? So on that level, all ecovillages, I think, are doing that work. And if you look at it that way, you can see that there are kind of two directions to ecovillages. There are communities in, I guess you'd call it financially rich countries, that are already living quite well. And their main idea is to say, well, how do we maintain that lifestyle but lower our footprint? And then, of course, there are communities in indigenous cultures around the world that are saying, hey, we want to develop. We want to have a better lifestyle. But how do we do that while also maintaining a low footprint and also preserving our resources and our cultures? So they're doing it from very different places, but they're actually trying to come to the same middle ground. Mm. So again, that's a way that they're all similar, but beyond that, their diversity is astounding. And if you can imagine what a community might look like that's doing that, there's probably something out there that approximates it, because the diversity is really, it's all over the world.
Yeah, and then what I also imagine is that in a way, how do we deal with conflicts? How can we live together with different opinions, different perspectives? And there comes just a sentence to my mind, which I heard from Terry Patton, whom I also interviewed in this series, was many of us, we say, I love humanity, but people?
Right. I think John Lennon said that too. Yeah, right. Well, I mean, let me back up a second. You know, I said that's sort of like what I see ecovillages doing, the high quality, low impact lifestyles. But if I could back up further and sort of the theme of this summit around conscious evolution, my sense is that there's basically one thing we're all doing here, which is how do we manifest love in the material world? To me, that's what it's all about. And ecovillages to me are sort of the best laboratory manifestation of that. And you know, they're not utopias. Sometimes I say that humanity as a whole, our species, we're in kindergarten, we're in preschool when it comes to where we need to be in relationship to the planet if we're going to survive as a species, if other species are going to survive. Ecovillages, you know, maybe they're third or fourth grade. You know, they're doing well, but they still have a long way to go as well. But it's that process. It's the intention to say, I'm going to try to do this. And it's not easy living in eco-villages. I mean, there's a wonderful sense of fulfillment and purpose and meaning, which I think really moves people forward. But day to day, sort of like running a wonderful social venture or nonprofit, it's not easy all the time. There's a Japanese saying that people are sort of like potatoes. You know, if you want to clean potatoes, you can just put them into a big pot of water and you shake. And just by the potatoes rubbing against each other, they clean each other. And people are like that too. And it has been gratifying being in communities where people enter into the community and, you know, they have some hard edges. They have strong opinions, or this is how this should be, or that should be. And over time, it's wonderful to see them soften a little bit and maybe listen to other people or hear other opinions before expressing their own. And I think that's a lot of what eco-villages offer us, is sort of that mirror to ourselves. It's you know, there was a person I remember in a community who had left New York City to go to this community. And he said when he left New York City, all his friends were saying that he was escaping to go to this, you know, this rural community. And then he decided to leave the community and go back to New York. And what he was surprised at is that all his friends in the community said the same thing, you're escaping. And when he thought about it, he realized that it was easier for him to escape from mainstream society, escape from himself, essentially, in an urban environment where you don't really need to interact with anyone. You can just do your life. I mean, it seems strange because you're around all these people, but it was much harder for him to escape himself and escape that personal growth in community where you can't fire someone. You can't say, well, I just don't want to see you anymore. I mean, these people are there whether you like it or not. And so you have to kind of roll with that. And I think that's part of the process of us growing.
Mm-hmm. And in your perspective, what would you say, how important is let's say some kind of spiritual practice or some kind of understanding what is beyond your personal story in a way? How important is that on this path towards really expressing love and materializing love?
I think it can be really important. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's necessary. I mean, for me, what's necessary is first an awareness and a sense of like, okay, this is what's happening. And then sort of an acceptance, like, okay, you know, I'm gonna live my life that way. With that, amazing things happen. And in some ways from that, I think our life becomes a spiritual path. Beyond that, spiritual practices, I think, certainly can help us understand and ground and do that acceptance work. But to me, the essential quality is really just that awareness and acceptance and working from that and living that way. And so I see lots of people in eco-villages that wouldn't consider themselves spiritual, but to me, they're doing deep spiritual work because they're looking at the question of like, how do we do this together? There's something about eco-villages and maybe the conscious evolution too that we could talk about, but that kind of spurred here. But I'll pause and see if you had other questions.
Mm-hmm. Now, what also came up was, in a way, I mean, maybe all of us kind of know that when we come together in close and intimate relationship, in a partner relationship, in a small family, those relationships tend to trigger really also old wounds, old conditionings we bring, which didn't went so well in childhood. And I just guess when we are close together with many people, the potential to get triggered, that might be quite strong. So what is your experience with that when you kind of are so close with many people and kind of unresolved issues you are still carrying? How do they show up? How do you deal with them?
Right. Well, living in community can be intense, and in both beautiful and difficult ways. And so the idea, the hope, is that the community creates a safe container where it's okay to be in process. It's okay to have those feelings. Often in mainstream society, you have to kind of hold those down. You can't kind of be that way at work or perhaps with your family. I mean, maybe you see a therapist and so you have an hour a week where you can kind of like let it out. I remember living at Findhorn in the early 90s and I'd be like getting mail and someone next to me would be getting mail. And you know, maybe I knew them, but not even close. And they would, I'd say like, how are you doing? And they're like, oh, you know, I had this dream and I think I'm processing this issue right from my early childhood and it's bringing it up in this relationship. And we might have like a 5-minute discussion and then it's like, okay, great. And then we go on with our day. And so there's a holding, there's a field where it's okay to be on this journey together. And just that welcoming, that acceptance is an incredible gift in community. And to the extent that we can offer that to each other and to receive it ourselves, I think it accelerates our evolutionary growth many times.
Yeah, and often I remember that often because we had for a long period really this regular morning circles where we did counseling and sharing. And often when someone had a topic and shared it, others said, I had almost the same dream, I'm in the same issue. And then you got a sense that it's not that personal what you are processing or digesting. Often it's really a issue which seems to be just in the field.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
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 And there's something I think really powerful in community, sort of like with the potato example, but like to the extent that we can let go of our personal ego and really see ourselves as part of something larger. You know, someone once said something I thought was quite wise. He said, most of us are probably familiar with this sort of nested hierarchy of systems that exists throughout nature in the world. I mean, if you just look at our body, right? We have nested systems. We have our organs and our lungs and our vascular system and all that. And each of those systems have subsystems, right? But even if you just look at the level of the organs, their purpose is us. So in any level of system, you look up for purpose and you look down for function. So us as a human being, those organs are functionary to us. Each of those organs have functionary elements to them to which those organs are their purpose. And so again, it sort of begs the question, it's like, well, if that's true, so here we are, all elements of something. So what's our purpose? You know, where what's that larger thing that we're a part of that we're striving together to manifest? And again, to me, it's all about how do we manifest love in the material world? And so eco-villages are an incredible opportunity and laboratory for us to look at, like, well, can we tune in to that thing, that essence, that consciousness that exists beyond what I might be able to experience individually, but I can touch it. And maybe I know that I'm an integral part of it as much as anyone and anything is. But to me, that's where a lot of purpose and meaning come in. And I'm also excited about how we do that organizationally. I recently had the opportunity to be a part of an alliance gathering of different organizations that are doing sort of sustainable community development work. And we were also looking at, well, how do we come together to create something larger? And I love that idea of sort of creating or making our borders a little more porous and maybe our organizational egos a little bit less. And just it comes from that recognition of what are we doing here essentially? What are we doing together? And how do we see ourselves as part of that greater whole? I think we're doing that, whether we like it or not, essentially, on all levels of our life. And it's in some ways, it's not even a choice. The only question is, how long will it take? But to me, that's what everything here is meant to allow us to explore.
Mm-hmm. And what really to break it down to something practical, what supports organization in opening their boundaries, in letting go of an organizational ego? What is it? What opens that?
Yeah. Well, one thing that comes to me is a big vision. When we were traveling around to communities years ago, I was surprised. Well, there were communities that had the big vision, that were about salvation, enlightenment, world hunger, something really big that they were trying to solve, a problem that they couldn't really solve on their own. And when someone once said that if in life, there's always going to be problems. But one of the keys to life that we often don't recognize is that to some extent, we get to choose our problems. And they said, if you get to choose a problem, choose a big one, like salvation or world hunger. Because if you choose a big problem, and in a community that chooses a big problem, the little problems tend to work themselves out. I mean, who's doing their share of the dishes isn't so important, right? And I found it was the communities that didn't have that big vision, that big problem, as it were, that who's doing their share of the dishes becomes more important. And those communities that don't have that big vision that are successful have to get really good at those systems. And so I remember a community in Virginia that really wasn't about something bigger, but they had umpteen systems. They had walls of clipboards, and this is how we do this, and this is how we do that. And it worked. It worked. But in some ways, I felt that was necessary. And sometimes I felt sad that if they just sort of latched on to something bigger, then other things kind of flow a little bit. So that's one response.
And maybe when I listen to you, I just get it makes sense in a way to have both, because also on an individual level or organization level or communities, there is this one direction which connects you to something higher, bigger, the vision, and then there is the day-to-day life where you kind of need to organize that something gets to be done, that there is some possibility to express some kind of action and to involve. So it, for me, it is really kind of this both directions.
It absolutely is, and I don't mean to diminish the mundane at all, because I think that's really critical. And that is something that I think communities have worked with diligently over the years and actually have evolved and have a lot to offer the world, I think. You know, years ago in the 60s and 70s, when there was this explosion of communes and communities in North America and around the world, many of them started adopting consensus decision making, which really came from Native Americans and the Quaker tradition. But one of the things that they did, I think maybe unfortunately, is that they sort of stripped it of its spiritual underpinnings, and it became just a system of governance and decision making. And over the years, it worked, and many communities still successfully use consensus, but a growing number of people have felt frustrated with it, feeling that it allows ruling by the minority. If someone just, you can block anything, and then people can do that for self-aggrandizing purposes or selfish reasons. And again, without the spiritual, what are we here for? If people are coming to a consensus decision-making, sort of like, well, it has to really work for all of us, it sometimes doesn't work for anyone. And so out of that, people have been experimenting with other systems like sociocracy that I think are moving the ball forward. And I think certainly we're all looking at how to do that. And it's exciting too.
Yeah. And what I heard once someone sharing was that community isn't about that it really works. It's about that you are in a field where you explore together and where you find out. It's not about that everything works.
That's right. Yeah. I remember living at Finhorn and being frustrated because someone would be in the I was talking to someone in the finance department, and they said that they had been in the garden for like a year or two. And one of the things they said to me says, you know, in that year, I don't think I added two numbers together. You know, all I did was commune with the devas, the elementals or the spirits of the plant world. And it was wonderful. But Finhorn and many communities offer that opportunity to really dive deep into some aspect. But then she said it was time to leave, and I moved into finance. And I think she was there for a year or two, and then she moved somewhere else. And it was frustrating because I felt like there wasn't a lot of continuity in a lot of the important functions of the community. And it helped me when I realized that the purpose of FinHorn isn't necessarily efficiency, or of many communities. It's not about how do we do this really well, because if that was the purpose, I think it might be structured differently. But instead, it's about how do we create a container for personal and planetary growth. And on that level, it made complete sense that people would do something for a while and then move to something else because they needed to explore that. So that helped relieve some of my frustration, I'd say.
And what are the ingredients for a container which can hold that or which can provide that?
Well, it requires a consensual story, a consensual purpose of like, why are we here? And this is why I think if people are starting a community, perhaps the most important thing is to really get that purpose as clear as possible. It will evolve, but if you can ring a bell really clearly, then it will attract other people that are looking at that same tone. And in that, you can create a container. And of course, there are things to do around creating safety and making sure that people's voices are heard. I think the idea of why are we here together is really important, because otherwise things fracture and then there's divisions and schisms and people are often in this internal fighting, and often that happens anyway. But it's important to be able to come back to like, okay, well, we essentially, what are we about? So I think that's one of the main things.
And what I also found out was really very interesting, that in a way you would maybe look that you come together with as many quite like-minded people as possible, but then on a sustaining level and practical level, we realized that a huge variety of skills, of expressions, coming together with the same vision and the same purpose, but variety and differences are very important for a whole organism to run. So when we bring this example you shared with the organs, a body needs different organs, not just 10 hearts. So that was really interesting for me to get a deeper clarity about that.
Right. Well, diversity is a key to a healthy ecosystem, and I think it's also key to a healthy community. So, I remember when I started Living Roots, one of my ideas was that we would only accept like environmental studies majors. I wanted like a crack team of like people who had been thinking about this and really could hit the ground running and really make things happen. And what I quickly realized is that it was the philosophy students, the engineering students, the religion students, you know, that made the biggest gains. The people who actually hadn't really thought much about sustainability or community, their lives like took a huge leap. And then I thought, well, what's the purpose here? Is it to really do something with the students in the communities, or is it really to help evolve these students' consciousness? And so quickly I realized, oh, we want a real diversity of students on these programs, because they actually help pull and push each other in really positive ways.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, maybe we can shift a bit more to this question. Where do you see, what is the contribution of communities in this process of evolving consciously towards really manifesting love in our world? What do they
think? I think that's a big question. I've been thinking about this lately. You know, I've been thinking about selfishness actually a lot lately. And you know how sociobiologists talk, Richard Dawkins talks about the selfish gene. And I've been reading about libertarianism, which is a political philosophy of freedom. There's a lot of things in it that I really agree with, some things that I don't. But the idea is that selfishness is the driving force of all people, right? That and through that, everything happens. And, you know, I guess a question that occurred to me is like, well, was selfishness there at the beginning of the universe? I mean, when there was just hydrogen atoms and gravity, were those hydrogen atoms feeling selfish? Like, I'm going to get together that. No, you can't do it. And I think no. And so at some point along the line, organisms evolved, and we could have a really interesting discussion around what does that look like on the physical level. I kind of think that ego started showing up when we started having the first solid membranes of single-celled organisms. Like when there was it was certainly rudimentary. I can't imagine that organism having a real strong sense, but there was a sense. There was this me and everything else. And it dawned on me that that was an incredible threshold of the universe. A threshold when suddenly there was a me and everything else. And at that time, that was incredible. It was an incredible technological advance in our conscious evolution, because before that, there wasn't that. And so when I think about this idea of people who say selfishness is what's driving us all, when it's clear that it wasn't there from the beginning of the universe, it both implies that ego is a stage in our evolutionary development, and that there's probably something underneath, something deeper, that both drove the evolution of the universe to the place where ego and selfishness arose. And maybe that thread that's underneath is continuing to drive us beyond that. So I think that we are here essentially to let go of our, to be in the ego, but for the ego to serve our consciousness rather than our consciousness to serve our ego. So it is important. We wouldn't be able to operate in the world if we didn't have a sense of me and you. But at the same time, how do we do that thing where we see ourselves, feel ourselves, experience ourselves as something larger? Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist monk, has a wonderful Buddhist community in Southwest France, Plum Village, which we also took students to, once said that Maitreya, the coming Buddha, the next Buddha, may not show up in the form of an individual, but rather might show up in the form of a community. And when I first heard that, I got goosebumps. I'm like, wow, what would that look like? What would an enlightened community look like? What would our experience be in community if that invisible space between us became the foreground of our experience? And each of us as elements of that community, each of us as separate ego, became the background. And that, to me, is what drives all of this. That, to me, is why I'm so excited about eco-villages, because as much in process as they are, to me, they are these cauldrons of that experiment of saying, how do we see ourselves as something larger? I've had the privilege of serving as the president of the Global Eco-Village Network for the last few years. And I freak people out sometimes when I say, look, as passionate as I am about eco-villages, about the Global Eco-Village Network, this isn't my purpose. You know, this isn't what I'm here about. What I'm here to do is, how do we manifest that love in the material world? And for me, eco-villages are perhaps the best form that I've found to really do that. To say, how do we put these potatoes in a pot and shake, and how do we help ourselves and each other really evolve in the way that I think we're all here to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to come back a bit to a point where I got also goosebumps, and maybe that's a good path to go a bit further, because when you mentioned this. Basically, I don't remember the words, but I remember the feeling when we put more awareness to the space than to the parts or the individuals, but more to the space. And what I also got then is kind of put more awareness to the substance we all are made of. And then there came this image of the ocean, which is water and wetness. So we share this wetness, but we have different forms as waves. We shape differently. So, and I guess a lot is in that kind of being in a way aware of this common substance we. And it's not just about us humans. What I just realize when I investigate deeply, 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 what am I? I always end up being nothing, feeling as huge as the universe, without any boundaries, without any, and I just, you know, I can't prove it. I'm not a scientist. I can't, but it just feels so real and so right that in a way, at least on one level, that's what I am. And on the other level, I'm also a wave. I'm a unique expression. I do look like different than anyone else. I express certain abilities different than other people do. Maybe the kind of voice, the tone in my voice, you only exist through me. So, and it's, I find it a really interesting paradox to be with this uniqueness and this limit and boundaries and matter, and then on the other hand, this nothingness, this right. just space. And yeah, I'm curious how is this also something which interests you, and how does it express, and where does it has a place?
Sure. Well, I'd call it a passion. I mean, I'm noticing the picture of Ramana Maharshi behind you, and the essential question of who am I, and continually asking ourselves that and getting to that place of, well, no, I'm actually not that. I'm not that. And there's nothing left, which is everything. And the way I see it is that there's sort of two aspects. I mean, on one level, there's nothing but love. There is that essence of the universe and beyond that is never changing. It just is. It's the beingness, the awareness. And then at some point,
I want to just interrupt you. Yeah. How do you know that it's like that? Not just as a concept, but what makes it that you are so sure about that?
Well, I mean, it's a felt experience. It's happened in times of meditation. And those goosebump moments, and when you just recognize that there's something really deep. And even if it wasn't, even if I didn't have that felt experience, to me, it would be a myth of choice, because it actually helps put other things into context. And so if there's that base, just awareness, just that isness, then at some point, I don't know how, but we decided, or it decided or whatever, to like try to figure this out in the manifest world, into the physical environment. And I think it's amazing that all this came from hydrogen and gravity, you know. It's like, and so to me, it's just this essential attraction, this love. Maybe gravity is love. And I really do believe that the universe has very simple rules. Maybe it's as simple as that. We're just attracted to everything. And out of that, we're singing opera, you know, as people say. And so, yeah, I have this theory. Physicists, I don't think agree with this, but you know how Einstein said that matter and energy are equal, E equals MC squared. There's a lot of energy in matter. Well, I have this idea that, well, maybe the other part of that is space. And so that matter equals energy equals space. And so one of the things that's really mystified astrophysicists is the idea that the universe is not only expanding, but it's expanding at an exponentially increasing rate. So you think if you like throw something out, it's not going to like go farther faster, right? So how do you explain that? And my thought is that rather than things moving apart from each other, what's happening is that matter is degrading into energy, which is actually creating space. So more space is being created between things in the universe. And if you take this to the nth degree, like trillions and Google years, or what is it, gajillion or whatever, a Googleplex years from now, when there's nothing, let's say, except two little pieces of energy, like in far distant parts of the universe. And then finally, those pieces dissolve into space. And so at some point, there's nothing in the universe but space. At that point, there's no distance. Because distance implies distance between things. And if there was just space, there would be no distance. And suddenly, phoom, it all can exist on the head of a pin, and boom, we have another universe. That's my personal theory. It's fun.
I mean, maybe it's not just a personal theory, because I recently listened to a speech of Peter Russell. He's in science.
Yeah, sure.
And he also said that also scientists come to the conclusion that there doesn't exist something like a thingness.
Right.
It's just the way our mind translate experience, and that puts it into thingness, into some a smell, into a taste, into something I can touch, into some form I can see. But he really said, we don't know how reality actually is, because everything what we experience is a translation.
Right.
And he really said they are at the point where they say things do not exist. And when I also, when I go deep and kind of expand and listen and be receptive, what I get is, I would describe it more as a movement. I feel a movement. I can sense, or I can also tune to a quality, what you would maybe say like silence, like stillness. But when I then open again towards that and I don't stay stuck, I feel a kind of movement. Hmm. And some people translate that the movement of consciousness is love.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had it in just my personal experience when because that is where I get curious, because many, many years I wouldn't really register a lot a notion of love, but I would register really the stillness, this nothingness. And then when I heard some teacher sharing that love is a movement of the stillness, and I started to experiment to not stay kind of rigid and stuck with the stillness, because I could see that when I entered the stillness, there was kind of this feeling I entered something important, something relevant, and there started to appear kind of a tension in my system where I was holding that. And when I then relaxed more and got more open, I could sense and receive this quality of movement. And when that happened, this notion of love came.
Yeah, I love that. I like that a lot. Yeah. I mean, that also talks very simply about those two aspects. There's the stillness of just that which is. And then certainly in the ephemeral universe, there's nothing but movement. I mean, we may have the illusion of solidity. I mean, the illusion is pretty strong, or stuckness, but really that there's nothing that stays the same forever except that essential stillness. And so it's yep. really interesting to say, how do we take that essential stillness? And then how do we have an awareness of that in the material ever-changing world? And to me, that is the purpose of the universe. That's how we're in this incredible threshold that we actually have an opportunity through our conscious evolution to have that awareness. I don't think that was there at the beginning of the universe. So what an incredible time to be alive.
Mm-hmm.
And this also, just this framing of it, I think it was Einstein who said, you know, the most important question to ask is it a friendly universe? And I'm really sad by how many people I talk to that have a really depressing story about humans and the world, the universe, thinking that war will never end and everything is going to go bad, and that there's going to be conflict and war everywhere all the time. And yet all of the data is showing us that all of those violent acts and things are declining. Yes, I'm a firm advocate in fighting climate change, and I think the coming decades and generations are going to be difficult. And we may not make it, you know, we don't know. And that would be incredibly sad. And at the same time, we have to recognize that it's not going to change the purpose of the universe, where things will just continue. It may take another couple million years to have this blossoming of diversity and conscious evolution. So it would be, to me and to all of us and to our loved ones, I mean, be an unfathomable loss. But it doesn't change anything. Essentially, it doesn't change what we're doing here. So to me, that's incredibly hopeful And I really enjoy introducing people to eco-villages because it does give them a sense of hope and a sense of like, no matter what's happening, all we can do is the best we can with what we have. And how do we create that greater sense of consciousness? And I do believe that it manifests in it and it carries on even beyond what we think. That's where I get a little hazy, like how do the patterns manifest into the implicate order of the universe and all that. But I think there's more in the universe than could be dreamt of in our philosophy. I think that was Shakespeare or something like that.
And I mean, Daniel, I know that you're also involved in creating programs to educate and with all what we shared, and especially when we are talking about this really being conscious also about our evolution, in your opinion, what is needed that educational programs also kind of cover that, not only, you know, supporting us in different skills or daily things or technology or social things, but really also this sense of maybe this space or nothingness or this higher vision or whatever you want to call it. Do you bring this also into your programs, or what is the role of it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. To me, that's the core. I mean, I'm reminded of a story a couple years back. I go to a conference every year about sustainability in higher education. And one of the workshops was an advanced workshop with the question of core competencies in sustainability. So these were people who'd been in the field for 10, 20 or more years. And the question, we were doing a roundtable discussion, saying if we could wave a wand, what would we want students to come away with after 4 years of studying sustainability? And I was the first to speak. And I said, look, this is good. I don't want to say we shouldn't do this. This is really important that we look at what competencies we want students to come away with. But I just want to take a minute and just step back and recognize that what we're talking about here is the what of sustainability. And I think it's as important, if not more important, to talk about the why. And for me, the why is about whatever we want to call it, interdependence, interbeing, relationship, connection. Because if we get that, if we can help our students get that sense that everything is connected to everything else, everything we talk about with sustainability flows naturally. It just makes sense. If we don't share that, if we don't help students get that awareness, then what we end up with is sort of a checklist of sustainability.
Yeah.
And I find many, many universities and colleges are really doing that level of sustainability. There are rating systems where schools are literally kind of teaching to the test. They're saying, oh, we have to do this because we want to get another credit around our sustainability score. And I'm like, really? Is that what we're about? I mean, isn't it about kind of like educating people? And so I said this, and the person across the table looked at me and he said, yeah, that's all interesting, this idea of interdependence and stuff, but really, that's your value. And I was like, what? Really? It's like, and I'm like, that's my value? And he says, yeah, I don't think we should be sharing our personal stories with our students. And I'm like, wait a minute. If there's anything that science has proven over the last 150 or more years, is that everything is connected to everything else. This isn't my story. This is what everyone, you know, all science is talking about. But it kind of dawned on me, I'm like, wow, here are people that have spent their professional lives in sustainability. And they're still not coming from that place of recognizing that why, that like this, because we're all connected, because there's this essential interdependence. And so that's what we do in our programs. And honestly, the curriculum is wonderful, but in many ways I see it as icing on the cake, because the essential experience is just being in community. You can be in community in colleges and universities. Many students go to school because they want to have that sense of comradeship. But often it's more one of proximity than community. It's the difference between if I'm at a lunchroom and I have my tray, asking someone, is someone sitting here, versus, hey, can I have lunch with you? Do you want to like talk? You know, there's an intimacy, there's an invitation that I think is available in community that we actually have to strive for. I mean, and I should say that we have to strive for it in community as much as anywhere. And a lot of people I've met in community think that they're in community when they're really just in proximity. So there is that conscious intent of saying, I am going to be vulnerable. I'm going to invite people into my lives. I'm going to hold the space for others. That is an intention. And I think that's what I think on our programs, I often say we create learning communities within living communities. Mm-hmm. So we create layers of that onion. And so we really spend time creating that sense of safety and for students to be able to share and explore mm-hmm. their own journey, but also seeing that sort of reflected at seeing themselves as sort of a microsystem for the macrosystem of the community they're a part of. And then, of course, that's part of a much larger mm-hmm. macrosystem. So long answer, but absolutely. Yeah, I think
but there is still something in I want to go. And what came to my mind was a similar, like you shared, Daniel, is a little grandmother said, when we love something, we care for it. Mm-hmm. So we need to love the earth. We need to love our environment. We need to love the people. Then we care. And you also said this really feeling, this connectedness, that is an aspect of, is another way to say I love. I feel that I'm deeply connected to you. And what supports, because some, or let's say many, many know this concept of all is connected, mm-hmm. but I'm deeply convinced that you deeply need to feel it, to get it, to experience that, then it comes to another level.
Right.
And what practices or methods do you apply in order to give people this possibility that they really can experience it so that they know it? So right. that there's not a matter of having a discussion about it or arguing, because you just know that it's right. a fact.
Well, to me, that's the magic of Ego Villages and communities, is that you barely need to do anything. It's just by being a part of it. You know, when I talk about Ego Villages, a lot of people will reflect back and saying, yeah, they're interesting, but they're kind of eccentric, marginal, kind of irrelevant to mainstream society. And when I hear that, I'll often reflect back and say, well, yeah, but remember that this is how we lived. For like 99.9% of our evolutionary history, we lived in human scale community. There were no strangers. You know, it's only been in the last 200 years or so with the Industrial Revolution when we've been able to separate ourselves from each other and separate ourselves from the planet. This is the weird time. You know, we're living in a time of amnesia right now. We've forgotten what it means to be in community. And to me, it's that forgetting, which is at the core of all of our problems. You know, we wouldn't do what we do to each other. We couldn't do what we do to the planet if we essentially recognized that we are all interdependent. It's just this illusion that we've created in the modern world that we are separate that is causing these problems. And so, to me, it really doesn't take much at all to reawaken that sense of belonging, being in a community where you see the pieces coming together, where there's a story being told. You're like, oh, you know, when we were at Finhorn, I was working in the kitchen for the first few months, and my wife, Monique, was in the gardens, and she would come with these wheelbarrows of parsnips, usually, which we tried to make look into French fries and fail miserably. But, you know, so she would dump these parsnips at the door, and we'd make dinner, and we would all eat this food that was really prepared with love. And then it would go into the compost. And, you know, you could see like, oh, I see how this all works together. And you can kind of feel that belongingness, where in mainstream society, in urban areas, it's very difficult to connect those dots. We can, and we need to, but I think the more dots we can connect and seeing ourselves in relationship, that is the essential work. And so again, on our programs, a lot of it is just helping the students connect those dots and then talking about what that means for them, what that brings up for them, and what it brings up from how their lives have been elsewhere, or how they perceive things in the world. It's really helping hone that that lens on our interdependence. To me, that is the core.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, it's when I got it correctly, it kind of naturally opens up again where we remember that this kind of a default way to be, basically.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I remember I remember when I started learning to meditate, and okay, you got to get into the now. You're right. And I'm like, how do you do that? Because it's like the past goes on forever. The future goes on forever. And it felt like I was like walking this tightrope. Like, there's no way. It's like, it doesn't even exist. It's this now thing that you're talking about. And then at some point it like dawned on me. Like it was sort of like, just like I laughed because I'm like, oh, there's nothing but the now. And suddenly the image was like, I was trying to walk on this tightrope. And suddenly I realized that there was a huge net and I could just fall back. And I could just relax into that net because it will catch you. The now will always catch us. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I feel like this sense of interdependence, the sense of belonging is the same thing. We don't have to strive to belong. We don't have to strive to feel interdependent or interbeing. That's the default. That is the essential reality. Mm-hmm. So anything that we're experiencing other than that, the question is, what is the hurdle? What is the glom or the shadow, or what is it that's keeping me from having that experience? Mm-hmm. So it's really about stripping away rather than building on. It's around, well, what is it that we've done in our lives that has created this illusion of separation?
Mm-hmm. And when I follow that, I also received this image. It's a lot of relaxing and letting go and just kind of being what naturally already is there without effort, basically, without the need to put effort or to make some all notions of tension and of kind of are contradictory to that.
Right. And we have that dichotomy, right? We have that tension of, we can have that fundamental ease, but also, how do we bring that into the world, into the physical world? And that's where, oh my God, I worked really hard because of this deadline. I have to do that. And so there's that too. But if we can do that with the awareness that we're doing the work that needs to be done, there is a relaxation even under the stress. Mm-hmm. And if we are choosing goals, if we have ambitions that we could actually achieve in a lifetime, we're not aiming high enough. So I think the best goals are the ones that we couldn't even begin to imagine achieving in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the image I also receive again and again is that it's just about making one step after the next towards a certain direction.
Right.
That's basically it. And the direction, when I listen really deeply and I tune in, it can change a bit. It can change sometimes radically, 180 degrees, or
I tell students that a lot too. It's like, well, what am I going to do? It's like, well, it's really about following. If you know what the next step is, do it. It's because it will lead to something. I shared my personal story at the beginning. It's like being president of GEN or creating programs, educational programs in Eco Villages. That wasn't on the radar when I was in college. It wasn't like, oh yeah, and you can go to school to like create educational programs to help people wake up to their fundamental sense of interdependence. I mean, it's like, but if I just kind of, well, this is what led to that, which led to that. And if it just always felt right, I think we, and are just kind of alert to those opportunities to say like, that's what I need to do. I think it was Louis Pasteur said, chance favors the well-prepared. And chance or not chance, however we want to talk about that. But if we kind of have a sense of that inner awareness and we can sense like, oh, that opportunity connects with that deeper longing that I have, then we're more likely to follow that path rather than get caught up in a lot of worldly concerns, which are valid, but I got to pay the rent and I got to do this and that.
Yeah, and then kind of there is also an openness that in a matter of a few years, what you are engaged in can be something quite different then it's no.
Well, yeah, and if it's not, then we should be asking ourselves something. Especially in this day and age, I think things are changing so quickly. And I think that's the most important thing that we can bring to the next generation, is that awareness of the fundamental purpose and that relaxation in chaos, because it's chaotic, and it's only going to, I think, get more so in the coming years. And so what do we do when systems fall apart? And many people have referred to the metaphor of the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. And as the caterpillar dissolves into the sort of nutrient soup, what are those imaginal cells? What are those patterns? And in many ways, I think of eco-villages as at least some of those imaginal cells in the world, that they've existed forever, really. But now they're sort of holding a pattern, or they're trying to create and recreate a pattern of connection of that is going to be incredibly important as things also, the divisiveness shows up more and more. I mean, we're either telling stories of separation or telling stories of unity. And being in North America, it's hard, well, anywhere in the world, I think it's hard to ignore what's happening in the States. But so many of the words and policies that are coming out, almost to the T, it's all about separation. You are different from me. You are lesser than. You don't belong here. Whatever. Whereas, how do we tell stories where we fundamentally belong? You fundamentally belong here. I fundamentally belong here. We've got to figure this out together. There's no other choice.
Mm. Yeah. Beautiful. It's just, I feel it really just rich what you shared now at the end. There is a richness and a meaningfulness in it, and kind of feels like all what we shared in this hour kind of lands into that kind of. But Daniel, I also want to give you the opportunity, if you want to share something, how could people maybe kind of connect with you or your different organizations you are involved in, or any programs?
Yeah, well, the CAPE Consultancy, it's the website is www.cape.consulting. So it's not .com or .org, it's cape.consulting. And from there, you can go to the blog, and the first blog post is talking about this new program that we're creating in Oroville, which again is an amazing community in South India. There's like 3,000 people from over 50 countries on 14 square kilometers of land, and they're trying to build, as they call it, a city the earth needs. So there's no place on the planet that I found like it. And so we'll be doing a program there in the spring and beyond. GEN, the Global Ecovillage Network, is just ecovillage.org, and there's lots of great information there. And then Earth Deeds, I don't need to get into. This is that other social venture, which is really an alternative to carbon offsetting, looking at carbon pricing. But you can find that at earthdeeds.org. And I'm happy to respond to thoughts and questions and ideas. And I want to appreciate you too. I mean, I feel like what you're essentially doing is telling stories of connections, telling stories of interbeing and looking at all the facets of the gem. And I'm looking forward to hearing the stories of others that are at the summit as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Daniel, for being part of this adventure, bringing your unique perspectives and your passion into the summits. I'm really happy that you kind of got the chance to sneak in.
Thank you.
And all the best to you, your family, and the programs you do. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you.